In our study this evening, we are recording tape number 5 in the series, The Human Will and the Deity of God, Human Choice and the Deity of God. Each one of the tapes is a 90-minute tape, and when this one is completed, we will have 7.5 hours worth of material recorded on this subject. I realize that many will not have the interest in this much material on this theme, or perhaps on any other theme. But for those who do have the interest, we've prepared the talks for you. It's quite interesting to observe, when considering scriptural matters, that people who are highly skilled and may be well educated and quite intelligent in general, when there is either a strong prejudice against a subject or else indifference toward it, one or the other, it's amazing how a subject and a treatment that is not really that complicated seems to be too much for such a person. And yet, a very simple person who is unprejudiced and quite interested can really advance very far. So the real matter is not so much intellect or previous education by any means, but the principal consideration is lack of prejudice and a high degree of interest in this consequential theme, as in any other one. Tonight I'd like to consider several different points that are further common objections or questions that come up. I'll just speak briefly on the argument that some have put forth, suggesting that man is on a tether, as they express it. They picture a donkey on a rope or a dog tied to a leash, and the idea seems to be that there are limits to where the animal can go, but within his range, he is one who is independent and has what is commonly called free will within his range, or at least it is said that man has his limitations, but within his range, he is running his own affairs and is able to avoid things. Well, I think if we'll at all consider the matter, however plausible and reasonable such an assertion may seem, the fact is that it merely diverts our attention from a consideration of the real issues which are involved in any consideration, be it something that we appraise as a minor or a major matter. It diverts our attention from the factors that are involved in any matter of human volition toward the undoubted fact that there are limits beyond which man in no sense can go. So it is hardly worth mentioning that. I don't think there's any question that that's the case. I'll just say briefly that within the range of those things which human beings do, the fact still remains that we have to think in terms of there being reasons for things, or causes for things. And the only thing we can do, if we would suppose that things which once were not, and yet in a given time come to be, if we claim that they just popped up out of nowhere, well, then we're speaking about chance. But I'll just say again that a cause, by definition, is that which produces an effect. That is, anything that happens for some reason or cause is brought to pass by its cause. Therefore, it is evident in the nature of things that once a thing is caused, it must be as it is. And if there really were such a thing as a chance or an uncaused event, though it would not be caused to occur, there would still be no way of preventing it from taking place. for as a thing of chance, it would be uninfluenceable. But either things are caused, or they are not. Either things are caused, or they are not. Now, if they are caused, then once they are caused, they must occur, and they then become unavoidable. But if it should be asserted that a given thing was not caused, then that thing is still impossible to be prevented from occurring. It is still impossible to prevent such a thing from occurring. That is, in the simplest of terms, caused events are unavoidable, and uncaused events, if indeed there were such a thing, could not be prevented. So the central idea of what is really being attempted and endeavored to be asserted by the talk of limited free choice or free will or that type of thing is really this idea that man's affairs are avoidable or preventable. But as I've just explained, even from a common sense point of view, if our prejudices are taken out of the way in order to exercise our common sense with a spirit of sanity, as Paul says, God giving us the spirit of sanity and growing in every sensibility, as he also says, then it is a very simple matter to see that if something is caused, then it has to be. And it certainly isn't avoidable once it's caused. And the only alternative is to say that if something is not caused, and they call it a chance event or an uncaused event, well, then it may not be caused, or it would not be caused, of course, in that case, but it still would be unpreventable. There would be no way to keep it away. So the idea that things are preventable or avoidable, in that sense, is utterly irrational by any standard. Now, this may be exceedingly unpopular, but I would appeal to those who would be unprejudiced and strongly desiring to know and be much more interested in sanity and sensibility and truth than they are in their own gratifications or one thing or another of prejudice. It certainly isn't enough, and actually it proves nothing, to list verses from the scriptures where the word choice or the word will or some equivalent concept is stated, and then to reason from that one's ideas about avoidability of chosen deeds or the preventability of chosen deeds is therefore approved and given approbation in the scripture. That is very much irrational and would not be asserted by anyone who was thinking clearly. For instance, we could turn to a passage such as 1 Corinthians 16:12, where it speaks of a man having it evidently not be his will to do a certain thing. Or in 1 Corinthians 7:37, of one who had authority as to his own will, whether to marry or not marry. And some people have this authority or power as to their will, and others do not. That's certainly true. Or in 1 Peter 4:3, the expression, the intention of the nations is spoken of. Or Ephesians 2:3, the will of the flesh is stated. Or we could turn to Deuteronomy 30, where the command is given to choose life. And yet we would turn to the passage in Romans 8 where the flesh is not able to obey God's law and fulfill the command that is given there in Deuteronomy 30. So these are complementary truths. And I think that will suffice to anyone who is open to what we would share on this theme, and they'll see it as readily as I do. And if one, of course, is locked up in stubbornness against these things, I don't expect them to accept a thing I say. And actually, the plainer I make it, the more they will rebel. One of the most common arguments that is given against our teaching of the fact that man is useless in himself and that he is not competent for anything, that the flesh is not benefiting anything, seeing that the heart of man is filled with evil, out of which are the exits of life, and that an evil tree cannot bear good fruit. Well, those things are simple enough, but they go against the pride and the self-righteousness of the flesh so profoundly that various things are appealed to in order to give some type of credence to the opposite position. And perhaps the most popular argument is pointing out that the scriptures just give line upon line, perhaps hundreds of different passages, where one group or person or another is commanded or entreated, as the case may be, to do and to believe this or that. Then it is reasoned from that fact that, therefore, man must have the wherewithal within himself, or at least after God should make such a thing possible, it must well lie within man's resources to carry this out, or else it would either be unreasonable or unjust or some other thing for him to be entreated or commanded. I know of no better reply to that claim and the persuasiveness that it seems to have on a superficial level than Martin Luther's reply to Erasmus, who made that charge hundreds of years ago, and this is Luther's book, The Bondage of the Will, which I would highly recommend as a very helpful study on this theme. I'll just read a few excerpts from Luther's reply, beginning on page 145. First, then, if I should demand of her, that is, of the writing of Erasmus, called the Diatribe, if I should demand of her, of Erasmus' writing, how it can be proved that the freedom of the will in man is signified and inferred wherever these expressions are used, if thou wilt, if thou shalt do, if thou shalt hear, she would say, because the nature of words and the common use of speech among men seems to require it. Therefore, she judges of divine things and words according to the customs and things of men, than which, what can be more perverse, seeing that the former things are heavenly, the latter earthly. Like a fool, therefore, she exposes herself, making it manifest that she has not a thought concerning God, but what is human. But what if I prove that the nature of words and the use of speech, even among men, are not always of that tendency as to make a laughingstock of those to whom it is said, if thou wilt, if thou shalt do, if thou shalt hear, that is, if one who was given that instruction was not able to respond to it in himself. Well, what would occur then? Luther says this, how often do parents thus play with their own children when they bid them come to them or do this or that, for this purpose only, that it may plainly appear to them how unable they are to do it, and that they may call for the aid of the parent's hand. I can say that I've done that with my son, and it's proven effective in some cases, and I think it's a helpful tool. Because when we won't believe that we don't have the wherewithal, when it's proven to us, it cannot be denied. How often does a faithful physician bid his obstinate patient do or omit, as the case may be, those things which are either injurious to him or impossible to the intent, that he may bring him by an experience to the knowledge of his disease or his weakness? And what is more general and common than to use words of insult or provocation when we would show either enemies or friends what they can do and what they cannot do? I merely go over these things to show reason, that is, reason personified, her own conclusions, and how absurdly she tacks them to the scriptures. Moreover, how blind she must be not to see that they do not always stand good, even in human words and things. But the case is, if she see it to be done once, she rushes on headlong, taking it for granted that it is done generally in all the things of God and men, thus making, according to the way of her wisdom, of a particularity and universality. If then God, as a Father, deal with us as with sons, that he might show us who are in ignorance our impotency, or as a faithful physician, that he might make our disease known unto us, or that he might insult his enemies who proudly resist his counsel, and for this end say to us by proposed laws, as being those means by which he accomplishes his design the most effectually, do, hear, keep, or if thou wilt do, if thou wilt hear, can this be drawn herefrom as a just conclusion? Therefore, either we have free power to act, or God laughs at us, as our opponents would charge. Why is this not rather drawn as a conclusion? Therefore, because God speaks thus, God tries us, that by his law he might bring us to a knowledge of our impotency, if we be his friends, or he thereby righteously and deservedly insults and derides us, if we be his proud enemies. For this, as Paul teaches, this is the intent of the divine legislation, Romans 3:20, 5:20, Galatians 3:19 and 24. Because human nature is blind, so that it knows not its own powers, or rather its own diseases. Moreover, being proud, it self-conceitedly imagines that it knows and can do all things, to remedy which, pride and ignorance, God can use no means more effectual than his proposed law, of which we shall say more in its own place. Let it suffice to have thus touched upon it here to refute this conclusion of carnal and absurd wisdom, namely, if thou wilt, therefore thou art able to will freely. The diatribe, that is, the writing of Erasmus, Luther's opponent, the diatribe dreams that man is whole and sound, as to human appearance he is in his own affairs. And therefore, from these words, if thou wilt do, if thou wilt hear, it pertly argues that man, if his will be not free, or that is able to carry out these things, that he is laughed at. Whereas the Scripture describes man as corrupt and a captive, and added to that, as proudly contemning, that is sneering at, and ignorant of his corruption and captivity. And therefore, by those words, such as, if thou wilt, and do this, and do that, it goads him and rouses him up, that he might know by a real experience how unable he is to do any one of these things. By God's law and his entreaty, his rules of instructions, that by them man is admonished of his impotency, which, without such admonitions, being proud and ignorant, he would neither know nor feel, at least as profoundly in many cases. In this, man is therefore shown by a terrible example, for the sake of breaking down our pride, what our free will can do when it is left to itself, and not continually moved and increased by the Spirit of God. These expressions and the like, if thou wilt, if thou hear, if thou do, show not what man can do, but what man ought to do. Erasmus then appeals to Deuteronomy 30:19, I have set before thy face life and death, choose what is good. What words, says the diatribe, can be more plain? It leaves to man the liberty of choosing, so it is claimed. Luther answers, what is more plain than that you are blind? How, I pray, does it leave the liberty of choosing? Is it by the expression choose? Therefore, as Moses saith choose, does it immediately come to pass that they do choose? Then there is no need of the Spirit. And as you so often repeat and inculcate the same things, I shall be justified in repeating the same things also. If there be a liberty of choosing, why has the probable opinion, quote-unquote, said that free will cannot will good? Can it choose not willing or against its will? But let us listen to the similitude. It would be ridiculous to say to a man standing in a place where two ways met, thou seest two roads, go by which thou wilt, when only one was open. Of course, that's the charge. And you see, if you don't thoroughly digest the material that I've set forth in these messages, then you'll have someone bring up some simple thing like that to you, and it'll stumble you. But if you follow these things carefully, you'll be able to make a very satisfactory reply to such charges and show how unreasonable and how untenable such things are, and that they only have a seeming persuasiveness at the superficial level and actually are nothing at all. Well, to the charge that it would be ridiculous to say to a man standing in a place where two ways met, "Thou seest two roads, go by which thou wilt," when only one was open, Luther says this: "This, as I have before observed, is from the arguments of human reason, which thinks that a man is mocked by a command impossible, whereas I say that the man by this mean is admonished and roused to see his own impotency." That is, these things will train us as we come to see that we are nothing. We will see that the only one who will either save us from getting into our failings or get us out of those failings that we do get into is the one true Savior, our God and Father, through the Lord Jesus Christ. True it is that we are in a place where two ways meet, and that one of them only is open. Yea, rather, neither of them is open. But by the law it is shown how impossible the one is, that is, too good, unless God freely give his Spirit and direct our way therein. Therefore, it would not be said ridiculously, but with a necessary seriousness to the man thus standing in a place where two ways meet, "Go by which thou wilt," if he, being in reality impotent, wished to seem to himself strong, or contended that neither way was hedged up. Wherefore, the words of the law are spoken, not that they might assert the power of the will, but that they might illuminate the blindness of reason, that it might see that its own light is nothing, and that the power of the will is nothing. By the law, or through law, saith Paul, is the recognition of sin. He does not say it is the abolition of, or the escape from, sin. The whole nature and design of the law is to give knowledge only, and that of nothing else save of sin, but not to discover or communicate any power whatever. For knowledge is not power, nor does it communicate power, but it teaches and shows how great the impotency must there be where there is no power. The whole that the law does, according to the testimony of Paul, is to make known sin, that man by the words of the law is admonished and taught what he ought to do, not what he can do. Heap together, therefore, out of the large concordances, all of the imperative words, those commands, into one chaos, provided that they be not words of the promise, but of the requirement of the law only, and I will immediately declare that by them is always shown what men ought to do, not what they can do or do. And even common grammarians and every little schoolboy in the street knows that by verbs of the imperative mood nothing else is signified than that which ought to be done, and that which is done or can be done is expressed by verbs of the indicative mood. Thus, therefore, it comes to pass that you theologians are so senseless and so many degrees below even schoolboys that when you have caught hold of one imperative verb, you infer an indicative sense, as though what was commanded were immediately and even necessarily done, or possible to be done. But how many slips are there between the cup and the lip? So that what you command to be done, and is therefore quite possible to be done, is yet never done at all, in fact. Such a difference is there between verbs imperative and verbs indicative, even in the most common and easy things. Whereas you, in these things which are as far above those as the heavens are above the earth, so quickly make indicatives out of imperatives, that the moment you hear the voice of him commanding, saying, "Do, keep, choose," you will have that it is immediately kept, done, chosen, or fulfilled, or that our powers are at least able so to do. And I would just add that Of course, when men do succeed and do the right thing, you know, to some degree in some areas, then we assume that we did this of ourselves. And if man were completely incompetent in his actions, then no doubt these truths would come clearer to us. But because we think we're doing fairly well on our own, then we don't recognize our need for God. And in fact, we are not doing the well that we do on our own at all. But God is working in us, directing men's steps, giving them the affairs of life, regulating their hearts, spirits, and actions, just as the scriptures declare. But the unbeliever doesn't know this, and the immature believer doesn't know it either. The next matter I'd like for us to consider is a popular charge that perhaps you've heard it said. People will say, why, we can choose any old thing. We can have two things in front of us, things that are utterly indifferent to us, and yet we can still select one of them. Well, what about that? The idea is, by that claim, that a person would actually select that to which he is indifferent. A great argument for so-called self-determining power is the supposed experience we universally have of an ability to determine our wills in cases where no prevailing motive is presented. The will, as it is supposed, has its choice to make between two or more things that are perfectly equal in the view of the mind. Well, this is the supposition. We suppose that we are actually choosing what we are utterly indifferent to. But let's consider this a little bit more carefully to see that that is really the case. And I'll read here from Jonathan Edwards' work on the will, The True Freedom of the Will, page 37. There is no great difficulty in showing, in such instances as are alleged, not only that it must needs be so, that the mind must be influenced in its choice by something that has a preponderating influence upon it, but also how it is so. A little attention to our own experience and a distinct consideration of the acts of our own minds in such cases will be sufficient to clear up the matter. So let's consider an example where supposedly there are objects of which one is going to be chosen, and yet these objects are objects of indifference. Thus, supposing I have a chessboard before me, and because I am required by a superior, or desired by a friend, or to make some experience concerning my own ability and liberty, or on some other consideration, I am determined to touch some one of the spots or squares on the board with my finger, not being limited or directed in the first proposal, or my own first purpose, which is general, to any one, that is to any one square in particular, and there being nothing in the squares in themselves considered that recommends any one of all the 64 more than another. In this case, my mind determines to give itself up to what is vulgarly called accident, by determining to touch that square which happens to be most in view, which my mind is especially upon at that moment, or which happens to be then most in mind, or which I shall be directed to by some other such like quote-unquote accident. Here are several steps of the mind's proceeding, though all may be done, as it were, in a moment. The first step is its general determination that it will touch one of the squares. The next step is another general determination to give itself up to accident in some certain way, as to touch that which shall be most in the eye or mind at that time, or to some other such like accident. The third and last step is a particular determination to touch a certain individual spot, even that square which, by that sort of accident the mind has pitched upon, has actually offered itself beyond others. Now it is apparent that in none of these several steps does the mind proceed in absolute indifference, but in each of them is influenced by a preponderating inducement. So it is in the first step. the mind's general determination to touch one of the 64 spots. The mind is not absolutely indifferent whether it does so or not. It is induced to do it for the sake of making some experiment, and so on. So it is in the second step and in the third. The thing that is misunderstood here by others seems to be that they make a mistake of the point in question, or at least do not keep it distinctly in view. The question they dispute about is whether the mind be indifferent about the objects presented, one of which is to be taken, touched, pointed to, etc., as two eggs, two cakes, which appear equally good. Whereas the question to be considered is whether the person be indifferent with respect to his own actions, whether he does not, on some consideration or other, prefer one act with respect to these objects before another. The mind, in its determination and choice, in these cases, is not most immediately and directly conversant about the objects presented, but the acts to be done concerning these objects. The objects may appear equal, and the mind may never properly make any choice between them, but the next act of the will, being about the external actions to be performed, taking, touching, etc., these may not appear equal, and one action may properly be chosen before another. In each step of the mind's progress, the determination is not about the objects, unless indirectly and improperly, but about the actions, which it chooses for other reasons than any preference of the objects, and for reasons not taken at all from the objects. That is simply to say that you would choose to select that object at a given moment which was the one most predominant in your view, but you would not be taking it because it was preferable in itself to another object, but simply because it was most prominent in your view. There is no necessity of supposing that the mind does ever properly choose one of the objects before another, either before it is taken or afterwards. Indeed, the man chooses to take or touch one rather than another, but not because it chooses the thing taken or touched, but from foreign considerations. The case may be so that of two things offered, a man may, for certain reasons, choose and prefer the taking of that which he undervalues, even, and choose to neglect to take that which his mind prefers. In such a case, choosing the thing taken and choosing to take are diverse. Can you follow that? There's a difference between choosing the thing taken and choosing to take a given thing. And so they are in a case where the things presented are equal in the mind's esteem, and neither of them preferred. All that fact makes evident is that the mind chooses one action rather than another, and therefore the arguments which they bring in order to be to their purpose ought to be to prove that the mind chooses the action in perfect indifference with respect to that action, and not to prove that the mind chooses the action in perfect indifference with respect to the object, which is very possible, and yet the will not act without prevalent inducement and proper preponderation. Another reason of confusion and difficulty in this matter seems to be not distinguishing between a general indifference or an indifference with respect to what is to be done in a more distant and general view of it, and a particular indifference, or an indifference with respect to the next immediate act, viewed with its particular and present circumstances. A man may be perfectly indifferent with respect to his own actions in the former respect, and yet not in the latter. Thus, in the foregoing instance of touching one of the squares of a chessboard, when it is first proposed that I should touch one of them, I may be perfectly indifferent, which I touch, because as yet I view the matter remotely and generally, being but in the first step of the mind's progress in the affair. But yet, when I am actually come to the last step, And this may involve a very short time, in an instant, and yet there are the steps involved. Yet when I am actually come to the last step, and the very next thing to be determined is which square is to be touched, having already determined that I will touch that which happens to be most in my eye or mind, and my mind being now fixed on a particular one, the act of touching that, considered thus immediately, and in these particular present circumstances, is not what my mind is absolutely indifferent about, but in fact, what I choose and prefer to touch. I have only included this material that I realize is not altogether easy in reply to the claim that supposedly we could choose something that we were indifferent to, in order to help us to have something profitable to reply to those who would make the charge so that you wouldn't be stumbled by it. I know the material is a little abstruse, but don't just say to yourself, because you don't get it the first time, that you'll never get it. You go over it 15 or 20 times, and maybe you'll get it real well. I have to do that to get these things. I don't get them the first time either, but I go over them 15 or 20 times, in God's grace, until I do get them. Well, let's consider another important point that needs to be considered. Perhaps you've heard many say that our teaching is a teaching that says God is the author of sin, they say. Well, number one, I would say, is it left to us to determine whether that is a good thing or a bad thing? And number two, that author of sin is a highly inflammatory and prejudicial expression. I replied to that charge briefly in one of the earlier messages, but I'd like to say some more about it now. And I think there's a distinction that we can make here. As, for instance, God certainly did foreknow long before Judas, for example, was born, that if he ordered things so, that there should be such a man born at such a time, and at such a place, and that his life should be preserved, and that he should, in divine providence, be led into acquaintance with Jesus, and that his heart should be so influenced by God's Spirit or providence as to be inclined to be a follower of Christ, and that he should be one of the 12, which should be chosen constantly to attend him as his family, and that his health should be preserved so that he should go up to Jerusalem at the last Passover in Christ's life. And if it should be so ordered that Judas should see Christ's kind treatment of the woman which anointed him at Bethany, and have that reproof from Christ which he had at that time, and see and hear other things which excited his enmity against his master, and that if other circumstances should be ordered as they were ordered, it would be what would most certainly and infallibly follow, that Judas would betray his Lord, and would soon after hang himself and die. And I would say that those who object that this doctrine makes God the so-called author of sin ought to distinctly explain what they mean by that phrase. Here I'm sharing from page 157 in Edwards' work on the will. I know the phrase author of sin, as it is commonly used, signifies something very ill, something very awful. If by the author of sin it is meant the sinner, the agent or actor of sin, or the doer of a wicked thing, so it would be a reproach and a blasphemy to suppose God to be the author of sin in such a way as that. In this sense, I utterly deny God to be the author of sin, rejecting such an imputation on the Most High as what is infinitely to be abhorred, and deny any such thing to be the consequence of what I have laid down. But if by the author of sin is meant the permitter or not hinderer of sin, and at the same time a disposer of the state of events in such a manner for wise, holy, and most excellent ends and purposes, that sin, if it be permitted or not hindered, will most certainly and infallibly follow, having been disposed and directed toward that end. I say if this be all that is meant by being the author of sin, I do not deny that God is thus the author, though I dislike and reject the phrase as that by which use and as that which by use and custom is apt to carry another sense. It is no reproach for the Most High to be thus the author of sin, if you will. This is not to be the actor of sin, but on the contrary, of holiness. What God does herein is holy, and a glorious exercise of the infinite excellency of His nature. And I do not deny that God's being thus the author of sin follows from what I have laid down. Well, I would only say that we would do well to stick to a pattern of sound words on these matters and simply say that God is the creator of evil, that He operates all, that He contrives all, that all is out of Him, and the evil that He creates includes those evil things which men do, most of which, as far as the human vantage point is concerned, are mistakes or sins for those men to be doing. And God is the one who has contrived all, including these events. Edwards says that it is most certainly so that God is in such a manner the disposer and orderer of sin is evident if any credit is to be given to the Scripture, as well as because it is impossible in the nature of things to be otherwise. And I think I've pointed that out amply in a number of different ways. In such a manner, God ordered the obstinacy of Pharaoh in his refusing to obey God's command to let the people go. Exodus 4:21, I will harden his heart that he shall not let the people go. I would say that in Exodus there are three different Hebrew words. There is the word harden, the word strengthen or fortify, and the word honor or glorify. Pharaoh honored and gloried in his own heart when he saw the power that he had, and God strengthened or fortified Pharaoh, and he also hardened him. He didn't merely harden him, but make him a weak hard person, or he didn't merely make him a strong person, but without hardness, but he both hardened him and strengthened and fortified him. And if you have the proper terminology of the rendering of Exodus, and if, maybe we can give a study on that sometime. I do have all those marked in my Bible, and when the concordant version of the Hebrew Scriptures comes out, you'll be able to see all of that. But I just say that briefly in passing now. In chapter 8, verses 2 through 5 of Exodus, Aaron thy brother shall speak unto Pharaoh that he send the children of Israel out of his land, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt by great judgments, and so on.